horses are more American than we are. And we built America off the backs of horses. There was no eagle and buggy. It was horse and buggy. The early 1900s, let's say, in the United States, we had almost 3 million horses, wild horses, 3 million. Because of the mismanagement today, our natural horse population in the United States was depleted significantly.
California's wild horse population has been shrinking dramatically from millions roaming the West a century ago to only tens of thousands today, raising urgent questions about their survival and the forces driving their decline. Today we're joined by William Simpson, founder and executive director of the Wild Horse Fire Brigade, who has spent years living among and studying wild herds in Northern California. In this conversation, Simpson shares first-hand experiences with wild horses, the true story of his decline, and why he believes preserving these herds is critical to California's environmental future. This is Bay Area Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Ispas. William, welcome to Bay Area Innovators.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you from Northern California. You're almost at the border with Oregon in the wilderness. And, you know, we're like 2 days into the Chinese New Year of the fire horse. And that's, of course, your logo on your website. But the first thing I want to ask you is, what is the most fascinating thing about wild horses that live in North America right now?
Well, there's actually quite a bit. When I grew up on a ranch with domestic horses and rode, and my brothers and sisters had horses. And so when I moved into the wilderness here and saw these horses, I was very surprised to see how they acted. They're small horses, 700-800 pounds. They're very athletic. They go places where only deer can go. I've never seen horses climb the sides of Rocky Mountains like, I mean, we have volcanic boulders here and lava flows where we are here in the mountains, and the horses just go right up that stuff. Never seen that before. They're very amazing, and the things they eat are unbelievable. You know, they eat all kinds of things that would normally kill a domestic horse. So I'm very surprised at their resilience, their ability to survive, how tough they are. Just so many things about them. It's unbelievable, Steve.
Now, you mentioned 700 to 800 pounds. For comparison, what does a domestic horse weigh?
Right. So these horses here were originally documented in 1580 by Sir Francis Drake. And that's according to the doctoral thesis of Dr. Yvette Running Horse Collins. She's a Lakota scholar, and that's a peer-reviewed, published PhD dissertation. And looking at these horses and the first explorers remarked how little they were. The bigger horses, the domestic horses that the Spanish brought when the Europeans came to the East Coast of the United States, those horses were really designed for human use, for cavalry, for conquistadors and for agriculture. So they were bred in Europe. For 6,000 years, a little bit more, for human needs, whereas wild horses in North America stayed the way they were. There was no breeding for desired characteristics like size and ability. And so these horses are 700-800 pounds, and because they have a lot of the original native genetics instead of the bred genetics like in the different breeds we have that the Europeans brought when they settled North America. And they needed big horses when you think in terms of a conquistador. You know, he's got armor, he's got equipment, a saddle, supplies, weapons. And so a conquistador probably weighed, and then with all of his equipment, everything, probably 300, 325 pounds, maybe even more, depending on how much supplies. And we know from equine science at major universities that you can't put more than 20% of a horse's body weight on its back. So what we mean is a native horse, which weighs 700-800 pounds, let's just say 800 for easy math. So if you put 20% of its weight, an 800-pound horse, that's 160 pounds. So obviously you can't put a conquistador on the back of a native horse. They're too big. But the horses that the Europeans brought were, 16, 17 hands, 1,500 pounds, almost twice as heavy. But and they could carry 300, 350 pounds safely on their backs. So, and that's the bit, that's one of the real differences right off the bat, is the size and the characteristic. You know, then they were bred for to hold a saddle too. They have longer backs even.
Now there is the herd, the wild horse herd over there. It's in your area. It's right next to your house, I believe. It sounds like you own it, or your organization owns it. How did that happen? How did you end up, you know, did you get to own the herd?
Well, that's a great question, Steve. So I retired up here. I came back from sailing 4 years at sea, and I wanted to be in the wilderness some more. I was in the wilderness of the Sea of Cortez for almost 4 years, which is a spectacular ocean wilderness. And I wanted more wilderness life. I really appreciated that. And so moved up into the wilderness mountains up here, right on the Oregon-California border, just on the California side. And, you know, when I first got here, and it was 2014, I started seeing these horses. And they were unusual. They were very unusual, because all my experience to that point had been with domestic horses. So right away, I started studying them. I went to school at Oregon State, pre-med science major. So I studied chemistry, physics, biology, botany, all that kind of stuff. And I started brushing off my science, and I started looking at these horses with some more of a scientific lens, so to speak. And as I did, I started documenting what I was seeing. And I also started telling the agricultural commissioner and people in the county that, hey, these are unusual horses. They're not your normal horses. Now, there were some inbred horses from, you know, releases from the cavalry and so forth in the herd here, but most of them had the what you call phenotype, the outward appearance of a true wild horse, small size, very athletic. And so I started documenting all of that and publishing all of it. And then in May of 2018, Colorado College had been reading some of my research, and they sent a graduate thesis team down to do a documentary about my research. It was called Fuel, Fire, and Wild Horses. And so they interviewed me up here with the herd and in the areas where the horses were grazing in big fire breaks. And so they were creating, this herd of 200 horses were creating large, what I call fire-resilient landscapes. In other words, large areas, 5,000-10,000 acres of areas where the fuel has been reduced significantly, because our deer aren't here to do it anymore. Our deer population on the West Coast has collapsed.
You mean the grass, right? So the horses eat the grass, yeah. Otherwise it gets yellow and then it's easy to burn. So
exactly. It's just what's on fire in Oklahoma and Kansas right now. You look at that fire, you know, they have a gigafire. It's just, and those are areas that are supposedly grazed by livestock, right? That's grass from last year. So it didn't get eaten by the livestock. The livestock industry says, oh yeah, livestock can take care of this. Well, their own livestock area over there is burning to the ground because there's prodigious fuel all over the place, grass and brush. So I started documenting that with Colorado College, and that was in May of 2018. And I was on camera talking about the horses right behind me. You could see the areas grazed. And then 2 months later, here comes a big fire. It was called the Klamathon Fire, and it started on July 5th, 2018, 2 months after the Colorado College documentary was filmed here. The fire department that came up here was from Fresno, so they were from, I don't know, it's 500-600 miles south of here. And because 2018, everybody, the fire guys were spread out thin across the states because fire's everywhere, like every year. So we had firefighters from Fresno, and they got up in the wilderness. And they had a map, but they didn't know where they were on the map. And I didn't evacuate. I stayed back. And my wife wasn't going to leave either because I was staying because they needed me to volunteer as their local knowledge advisor. And so I helped them, and I showed them where all the roads were that weren't on the map. Their map was totally incomplete. It didn't show where all the logging roads were, where the ranches were that needed to be ready, prepared for fire. You know, you got to do fire prep around these buildings and so forth. And so I became their local knowledge advisor, and I was on the fire line for 9 days. And I saw what the horses did during the fire. I saw the benefit of their symbiotic grazing on the landscape. Because that's where we stopped the fire, right where I said, it's interesting, everything I said in the May 2018 documentary which is called Fuel, Fire, and Wild Horses, everything I said in that came true 2 months later in an actual wildfire. So, the you know, talk about proof of concept, we have it. Okay, so all of that was documented again by another documentary that came out back in 2024 called Horse of Nature, and that's an award-winning documentary now.
The main point is that the horses are grazing the grass in a way that it doesn't destroy the landscape. It doesn't, you know, destroy it. And at the same time, it reduces the chances of fire, right?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Steve. Horses, unlike it, there's no other animal in North America like a horse when it comes to grazing. And the reason is when they eat the seeded plants, you know, grass and other plants produce seed. And those seeds fall on the ground and then grow next year. Well, when a horse eats those seeds, most of them come out in their poop and grow. So they actually are like farmers. They walk around and the seeds come out, you know, they poop them out and they grow. The other animals on the landscape don't do that so much. You know, you look at, they're called ruminants. A ruminant has a multi-chamber stomach, so they chew a cud, and they're very good digesters. Cows, sheep, goats, elk, and deer, and bison are all ruminants. When they eat the seeded grass and plants, they digest most of those seeds, so they don't replant what they just ate. The horses do that. So you're right, Steve. They not only do they reduce the fuel load and make the area fire resilient, but they also reseed it so that the following year the plants come back, and that benefits all the other animals. They actually grow more than they need. So they plant enough crop. The horses plant enough crop for the deer and the elk and the rabbits, and even the bees and butterflies benefit because they need flowering plants.
So now, do you take care of the horses in any way? You know, they're on their own, obviously, but what do you do with them? Do you, you know, observe them, take care of them in some way?
Well, yeah, and I'll finish answering your question, Steve, because how we got ownership was, we gave all of our data from the fire to the local ag commissioner, and my wife was killed by the smoke because the toxins now we see in the wildfire smoke are new. The fires are much hotter, so there's a new kind of chemistry. It's called pyrochemistry. And so when you heat the chemicals in the plants and the trees at a higher temperature, you get brand new compounds forming that we never saw in fire before. And we know the fires are hotter because now we're seeing molten aluminum engine blocks, mag wheels, molten aluminum ladders on these fire landscapes. We've never seen that before. So we know the fires are hotter than 1500 degrees Fahrenheit because aluminum melts at 1500 degrees. Some of these fires are even hotter. We're seeing deformed steel beams, and that doesn't happen until you get to about 1800 or so. So we're getting new toxins. Now, I got lung damage. I was on the line 9 days helping Cal Fire as a volunteer. But my wife stayed back to support me and to watch the horses because neither one of us knew what the wild horses would do during the fire. And so she stayed back. Well, she got sick a couple weeks after the fire. She developed an autoimmune neurological degenerative disease from the toxins in the smoke. And that was in 2019. She passed away. And I learned a lot about autoimmune disease from smoke because I was researching along with all the doctors trying to figure out how to save her. But all of that information went to the Ag Commissioner and the county officials. And so, you know, Laura passed away because we couldn't, you know, the best doctors in the world couldn't save her. We have doctors from Mayo Clinics, Johns Hopkins University, the very best people in the best hospital in Portland, Oregon. And nobody knew what did it. Even CDC flew in. I told them my hypothesis was it was the smoke, but I couldn't prove it. Now, in 2024, UCLA came out with their 11-year study. So UCLA found out that 5,000 Californians are dying prematurely every year from wildfire smoke now. And so over the 11-year study, 55,000 Californians died prematurely. We're talking about men, women, children, and you can be at a great distance from the fire. You could be 100 miles away. And if you breathe these toxins, these new toxins that are coming out of the fire, it kills you. If you're genetically susceptible. So I didn't realize my wife was one of 5,000 people in California that died that same year with unknown cause, except UCLA was finding out what it was. And now, to just kind of put the cap on that so people truly understand what we're talking about here, the American Chemical Society just came out with a brand new study, December of 2025, that said that, oh, we found out that there's 21% more toxins in the smoke than we knew about, and they're in the class of volatile organic compounds that are semi-vaporous or particulate in nature, so they penetrate deeper than PM 2.5 into your body. They go right into the cells.
Where do those come from? From the wood, or is it from other things that burn?
It's an aggregate of things that are happening at these new higher temperatures of these fires. So these fires are almost twice as hot, and it's a function of all the fuel, right? So it's a pretty simple thing when you think about it. It's so obvious people miss it. In California, or the whole West Coast, is the deer and elk populations are collapsed. In California, we know we're down about 1.5 million deer. Now, 1.5 million deer eat about 3 million tons. That's a really big number, because a ton is 2,000 pounds, right? So 3 million tons. So if you want poundage, it's 3 million times 2,000, and then you know how many pounds of grass and brush. So 3 million tons of grass and brush in California alone were being eaten by the deer that are gone now. So all that grass and brush is there. So when that burns, it burns abnormally hot. The fires are hotter than they've ever been before. It actually heats the ground up so hot, it pasteurizes the soil. It kills all the microorganisms in the soil 10 inches deep. Everything is dead. All the microorganisms that make plant food, you got all these different bacteria and virus and fungus and mycelium and all these things that live in the soil. And all those things actually digest, they convert inorganic minerals into organic or basically chelated minerals that the plants can use. They get killed. Okay, they're dead. And then the root systems are all destroyed, so there's soil instabilities and all kinds of problems.
William, let's go back to the horses, because I think the whole point is how the horses are able to deal with this problem. I think we need to point out that how many wild horses are there now in California versus 100 years ago or the past? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the horses, what's happening, because we don't have our other herbivores, they're gone. Overhunting, you know, disease, poaching, vehicular accidents have removed our deer. You know, we're really low on our deer population. And of course, there's some predation by lions and bears and wolves, but predation becomes more intensive when the prey animals are balanced with the predators. You don't have a collapse, but when something else is taking your prey animals way down, suddenly the ratio of predators to prey is really skewed. And so that's why we have all this grass and brush. Our herbivory is down. The horses have, you know, where I am, have been very effective at removing grass and brush because we were missing a lot of deer. So when we're looking at the deer populations and the elk populations and the horse populations, you know, when we go back just to recent times, the early 1900s, let's say, in the United States, we had almost 3 million horses, wild horses, 3 million. Because of mismanagement over the early 1930s, you know, people were killing them for dog food and just taking them, and a lot of them got, a million horses got sent to Europe for World War I. Our natural horse population in the United States was depleted significantly. And so in 1971, President Nixon was made aware of this. And so in 1971, President Nixon signed the Wild Free Roaming Wild Horse and Burro Protection Act. At that time, there was only 25,000 horses left in America, wild horses. There was a lot of domestic horses, but we were down to 25,000 wild horses.
From 3 million to 25,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, And so President Nixon says, okay, they're protected. And what he said is they can't be rounded up, they can't be harassed, they can't be branded, they can't be killed. Well, the BLM does all of that on TV today.
BLM is the Bureau of Land.
Bureau of Land Management. I'm sorry. I should have said that, Steve. Yeah, Bureau of Land Management. So they're actually violating the precept, the very beginning, the preamble of this very important act. Because, you know, when we think about it, we built all of civilization in the world was built with horses. Horses are man's best friend, and we built America off the backs of horses. There was no eagle and buggy. It was horse and buggy. Okay, it wasn't eagle and buggy. Because of the mismanagement today, we're seeing that we're rapidly approaching the 25,000 threshold again, which is what triggered the act to protect them. The Bureau of Land Management is currently rounding them up. They're sterilizing horses that are still out there, and they actually incentivize wild horse nonprofits. That's a oxymoron. Some of these people that claim to be saving wild horses are actually getting paid by the BLM to shoot them with chemicals that sterilize them. And it's a very simple biological proposition. No babies, no future.
Why do they do that? Why they want to continue the species? Why would they do that?
Well, here, the problem we have today is when President Nixon protected them in 1971, he gave horses 53 million acres to live on, to be wild and free, and to be where Americans can enjoy them as part of the natural part of the ecosystems. Well, since 71 until today, we have 100 million more people in America that all want products and services. And a lot of those products and services come from public lands, including livestock production. It comes from, so the Bureau of Land Management leases land to livestock, gas, mineral, oil, mining. All those people are stakeholders. And then you have the hunting industry, because there's deer and elk as well on public land, and they have a stake in how it's used. And then you also now have the horses there that President Nixon wanted to be there in 71. So the Bureau of Land Management looks at that and they go, well, we don't make any money off these horses. We make money off of all the other things. The horses, yeah, President Nixon protected them, but so what? So now they're just getting rid of them, because if they get rid of them, they can have more livestock, more gas, more oil, because the horses won't be in the way.
Yeah.
And because they don't have a better idea. Now, I'm trying to educate them. There is an easy way to solve this problem where you don't have to decimate our cultural heritage tradition. You know, these horses are part of America. It'd be like shooting John Wayne in the middle of his career. You know, I mean, killing these horses and doing what they're doing is a horrible thing to do. It's horrible.
Can you share with us some stories that you have encountered with the wild horses? You know, you get to know them. I think in one of your videos, your movies, you get to know their, you know, they have names, you know, just any stories that come to mind.
I believe it was in 2023. Yeah, 2023, we started a fellowship program with California State University to start teaching wild horse ecology up here. And we got ownership of the herd in March of 2022. So because these horses didn't have any ownership, and that's a term, you'll hear the term feral horse a lot. When it comes to horses, it's not like a cat that you let go and it feralizes. When in terms of livestock and horses, feral means without ownership. It has nothing to do with their genetics or their origins, okay? So if a wild horse walks off one of the herd areas where they're supposed to be protected, they suddenly can become a feral horse or unauthorized livestock, depending on whose land they're standing on. But because in our county, in Siskiyou County, the Ag Commissioner has absolute jurisdiction over feral animals, including feral horses. So this herd was considered feral, meaning without owners. And because we had put so much time and money into them, and then, you know, over all those years, I was putting $8,000 a year of my own money into rescuing horses, taking care of sick horses, because I realized that they were a precious resource. And even the older ones, I wanted to try to extend their life, because they had rare genetics, right? So I wanted to try to give them more life and maybe get more babies. And we needed them because of the fire fuels. So the county recognized our ownership, as you cited a little bit earlier, by letter. We have a letter. It's at our website, wildhorsefirebrigade.org. We have a letter there that talks about it and our herd. But when we started our fellowship program with Cal State, we started bringing university students up here. And I'd been up with the horses so long, the horses see me as one of them. You know, I did what Jane Goodall did in Gombe, Africa, right? Jane was finally accepted into the troop as one of them. No other scientist was able to do that in Gombe, Africa. But Jane had a very good, they recognized her as a very caring, loving person. You know, the animals are very sensitive to people. And that the head of that group of apes, the big, powerful male ape, realized Jane wasn't a threat and she was a nice lady. And he didn't care if she was in with his family. And she got to sit down with the apes, and that's when she saw them making and using tools. Well, up here, I emulated what Jane Goodall did. I actually call it the Goodall Method in honor of Dr. Jane Goodall. And she's aware, before she passed, she was aware of what I was doing, and they tweeted out what we were doing. NPR did a story, and they actually retweeted it, that, you know, I was using the Goodall Method here. And Jane really showed that being an embedded observer has a lot of advantages. And so, to answer your question, when students started to come up, because I was used to being with all the horses, we named them all, and we knew them all, and I could go up to a wild stallion off the mountain and pull ticks off of them, you know, and it's mutual grooming, it's an accepted social behavior. But what was for me was seeing the wonder in the eyes of these students when they came up here and saw these, you know, I mean, these are wild stallions and mares, and when you watch them, you can see, you know, they got God's thunder in their hearts, and, you know, they're just an amazing being that you can feel the power they have almost, that even at a distance. And, you know, seeing the students come up here and watching their wonder, you know, I was thinking, you know, I sort of got used to it. You know, I've been with the horses so long, you know, for 12 years now. You know, you kind of get used to something. But so when the students came up, for me, seeing their excitement, you know, it brought me back to the first day when I was here. And I saw that, you know, it kind of let me relive it a little bit, you know. And so it was really interesting. But the students that come up here, they are just totally, you know, in shock to see that we actually still have wild horses in North America, because they heard there wasn't any left.
Now, these horses you cannot ride, right? If you ride, they're not going to like it. It's like we see in movies that when they kind of try to throw off the rider of their back. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we don't do that. Because we own them, we have a duty to provide a level of care now, because now we're considered livestock owners. Okay, so under the laws of jurisdiction, when we got ownership, now they're considered under the law livestock. So they're protected under California livestock law. And we have a duty to provide a minimum level of care, just like all the other livestock people that have cows and sheep. They have a duty to provide a certain level of care. But we use low impact management. We don't want to take away any wild attributes. We don't want to habituate them. We don't want to make them domestic. We don't try to ride them. We don't put halters on them. We don't do any of that. We do catalog them, and that's part of what we do with the California State University. The students come up, and we've engaged in research. We've cataloged, we've photographed all the horses. We have a digital database. We also have a manual written database with pictures, hand-drawn pictures of each horse and identifying marks. But we have photographs, and then we have data, and we're building the ethology, and we're going to also start managing our genetics of the herd. And we're working with master students, too. We've had people up from UC Davis, California, and working on our programs, our research, to show just exactly how valuable they are for fire management. Because they also break off the low ladders, the fire ladders on trees. When you look at a tree, it's got all these dead limbs down low. And if you got grass underneath it, when a fire reaches that tree, the grass burns and lights all the dead limbs up, and the whole tree turns into a matchstick. Well, the horses not only graze the grass, they break off all those low limbs. So those trees are fire resilient.
So William, please tell us about your personal connection with the horses. How is it happening?
Well, I've formed, you know, the equivalent of friendships with a lot of the horses. They sense who you are. And for a long, long time, people would call people horse whisperers or all that kind of thing. And now we have a new branch of science called biofield medicine. And so we know that all living beings produce an electromagnetic energy that's measurable now. That's subtle. That's science. We know it. And so these horses, you know, they sense your energy and a lot of other things about you. And so I have horses that when they see me at a distance will come up to me, and we're friends. You know, they've become very important friends to me, because when they're near you, you actually can kind of feel in a way how much they care for you. It's a feeling you get, and it's hard to really discuss it because we don't have the words to articulate it yet. We haven't developed that lexicon, but there is this, Heart Math in California is looking at why do PTSD people benefit from a horse, and now they're using electromagnetic measuring equipment, and they see that the energy field from a horse when it encompasses a human with depression or war veterans that have terrible PTSD, that energy from that horse helps heal them. Well, with me, it gives you a feeling. You actually feel good when you're around them. Like you're around your best friends. You just feel. We don't have to talk. You just feel it. And the students that come up here from Cal State and other places feel it too. They come up here and they go, wow, these are amazing. They're amazing sentient beings. And, these horses, they actually protect me and Michelle. After Lori passed away about a year later, I met a wonderful woman. She's part Cherokee, and she's been up here helping me with the projects and so forth. And her name is Michelle. They immediately bonded with her. She has that indigenous part that she's part of that coevolutionary overlap with the indigenous peoples in North America. They have that. And so I think we have a duty to protect them because we have more horses in government prison camps now. And we're all paying $150 million to the government to keep them there and feed them grass when everything's on fire out here. We have places you could put them where there's no economic conflict. But the government is just so blinded and myopic in their approach, they don't realize, let's just move those guys out of that government holding into this remote wilderness, and you save $150 million a year, and then you also reduce wildfire, and then you reduce those 36,000 deaths in the western United States every year. And that costs $218 billion. That's health alone. That's not structural. That's not property and casualty damage in the insurance industry. That's another $50 billion a year. So, they can help us again.
Yes. William, we thank you so much for your time. It's been very educational, very interesting. The horses are, like you said, the animals that have been here the longest, and America was built on the back of their horse. So it's been great having you on our program. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, people, just before we hang up here, I'd like to say that, we're an all-volunteer organization, and we survive off donations. We have no government grants. We don't take tax money. We're funded, including our student program with Cal State. We're funded through donations from generous people. So
please tell us the website. Tell us the website one more time.
Yeah, the website is wildhorsefirebrigade.org. If you Google just Wild Horse Fire Brigade, you will find it. And if you want to see the documentary movies, you go to Horse of Nature. So that's horse with an H. horseofnature.com, and there's the documentary movies about what we do there.
Fantastic. Again, thank you, William.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you, and see you next week.